This is Eric Alexander, and I will be reading the 2026 March issue of National Review. Trump makes Powell his pinata. Lawfare against the Fed chairman is meant to bully him into bad economic policy. By Andrew C. McCarthy. The Justice Department's criminal investigation of Jerome Powell, chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, displays all the Trump administration's now familiar seaminess. It is a retributive politicization of law enforcement, lawfare through and through. Its motivation is disreputable, an attempt to extort the chairman, a pinata for Trump, into adopting economic illiteracy. And as ever, subordinates pursuing petty but conflicting agendas, in their haste to please the overlord, have ignited a firestorm that defeats the administration's purported objectives. In its most lasting consequence, though, the episode illustrates that the framing of a constitutional dispute over the administrative state, which has heated up since the first weeks of the second Trump term and is careening towards Supreme Court resolution, has put the cart before the House. Notwithstanding the administration's vehemence, the president's authority to fire the heads of agencies such as the Fed without cause is not the critical issue. That is just a corollary of the fundamental flaw. These agencies violate the separation of powers, enabling the president or his appointees to superintend legislative functions. Although Powell was elevated to Fed chairman by Trump in 2017, the two have had a stormy relationship from the get-go. To be sure, there are many legitimate criticisms of Powell's stewardship, particularly on inflation. Yet, Trump's case against him is strictly political and misconceived. Powell will not give Trump the easy money he desires. Trump was reelected despite deep political public reservations, but the expectation of a return to the economy of his first term, during which, despite his quotidian tantrums and some tariff foolishness, he took the advice of seasoned subordinates. Alas, the second term Trump is more self-assured. The relentlessness and capriciousness of the tariff onslaught, coupled with sundry statist misadventures, have not brought the anticipated relief from high Biden-era prices. The uncertain climate created by Trump's mercurial machinations undermines business expansion. Moreover, the country is now $38 trillion in debt, such that interest payments at about $1 trillion per annum and rising exceed the defense budget, while Trump eschews the political risk of addressing entitlements, the primary driver of debt. In these straits, the president needs a scapegoat, and Powell is his man. He has branded the Fed chairman Mr. Too Late, always too slow and timid about cutting rates, a clueless numbskull who doesn't know what he's doing. Concurrently, Trump has let it be known that he is unhappy with Attorney General Pam Bondi over what he somehow sees as a slow pace of indictments against his political enemies. The president won't accept that the conduct he wants probed, particularly the 2016-17 Russiagate hoax, besides being stale under the 5-year federal statute of limitations, is of dubious criminality. As Trump of all people should grasp, abuse of power often do not violate criminal law. By the president's light, since Democratic prosecutors had no problem hounding him, the lack of adequate action by his own prosecutors must signal disloyalty and incompetence. Meanwhile, courts have thrown out the major indictments Bondi has already brought against Trump nemesis as New York Attorney General Letitia James, who brought a bogus civil fraud case against Trump, and former FBI Director James Comey of Russiagate infamy. At a White House photo shoot in early January, the president lambasted district U.S. attorneys for their tremulousness. The next day, federal prosecutors in Washington, D.C., under the direction of Trump-appointed U.S. Attorney Jeanine Pirro, sent grand jury subpoenas to the Fed. The claim was that Powell misled Congress last summer when testifying about the lavish renovations of two Fed buildings. The probe is an unworthy exercise, especially given the grandiosity and cost overruns of Trump's own vanity project, the East Wing Ballroom. Because the Fed is self-funding, taxpayers are not footing the bill for construction on its buildings. By Washington's profligacy standards, the surge passed initial cost estimate to about $2.5 billion from the original $1.9 billion is neither remarkable nor difficult to explain. COVID-era supply chain woes and inflation have raised construction expenses everywhere. Transparently, then, the Powell investigation seeks to manufacture a statutory basis misfiance or malfiance for Trump to remove Powell. The objective is inane. Powell's term as Fed chairman lapses on May 15th, so Trump will get to replace him anyway. Although Powell's separate term as a Fed board governor runs through January 2028. If press reports are accurate, the driving force behind the Powell probe was Bill Poult, the director of the Federal Housing Finance Agency. He'd previously pushed dubious mortgage fraud investigations of the aforementioned Letitia James, Senator Adam Schiff, an orchestrator of the two first-term impeachments of Trump, and Lisa Cook, a Biden-appointed FedGov, whose seat Trump also hopes to fill with his own appointee. Poult, a Trump donor with a degree in journalism, is not a lawyer and has no experience investigating financial crimes. He has the president's ear, but denied any instigator role in the Powell probe. At least after Powell is issued a forceful public statement about it, prompting the consternation across the board, even from notoriously supine congressional Republicans. The bank fraud charges that Poult earlier championed against James have proved so weak that Erica Seibert, the Trump-appointed interim U.S. attorney in Eastern Virginia, declined to bring them. Trump furiously cast Seibert aside, replacing him with a loyalist, Lindsey Halligan, an insurance lawyer and White House aide who'd never been a prosecutor and who Bondi has now announced is out. Halligan indicted James, only to have the case first thrown out by a judge over grand jury irregularities and Halligan's lack of qualification under controlling statutes, and then rejected by multiple grand juries when Bondi tried to have it reindicted. Halligan's indictment of Comey was also thrown out by the court. Once burned, prosecutors are twice shy, refusing thus far to bring against Schiff and Cook any charges that rely on Poult's scouring of government mortgage files. Trump has nevertheless tried to fire Cook based on unproven claims of financial shenanigans, but he has been blocked by the Supreme Court. The justices will rule this term on Trump's authority to remove to remove agency heads and on whether different rules should apply to the Fed. Trump seems nonplussed by the political blowback. The Justice Department, quite aware that central bank independence is popular, has had already conceded to the Supreme Court that presidents should not have the same unreviewable discretion to remove the Fed governors as to fire heads of other agencies. It is perhaps no surprise, then, that Pirro was quick to portray the subpoenas as a big misunderstanding caused by the Fed's failure to respond to an informal inquiry about the renovation, as though the prospect of indictment was a figment of Powell's overheated imagination. Most frustrated, it appears, is Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, one of Trump 2.0's most competent officials. It was Bessent who, at a private September dinner attended by Trump's officials and advisors, threatened to punch Pult in the face for bad-mouthing him to the boss. The secretary had reportedly been working on a plan to maximize Trump's impact on the Fed, simultaneously paving the way to get an as-yet-unnamed Trump nominee to replace Powell as chairman through Senate confirmation while cajoling Powell to leave the Fed's board early. That would enable the president to fill two seats, maybe three, depending on what the court ultimately decides in Cook's case. The Powell probe appears to have blown up the plan. The nomination fight over Powell's replacement promises to be fierce. Powell's incentive is now to hang on as a governor until after the 2026 midterms, which could empower Democrats to block Trump's future Fed nominees. The White House lawfare against Powell can't help the administration with the justices. That last one is the essential issue. Since the start of his second administration, Trump has agitated to rein in the administrative state by asserting unilateral executive authority to remove agency heads, despite statutory mandates that good cause must be established. At issue is Humphrey's executor, a 1935 precedent in which the court, in a seeming departure from precedent, upheld such restrictions against FDR after FDR tried to terminate a member of the Federal Trade Commission. The spotlight on yet another episode in Trump's reification of Arthur M. Schlesinger Jr.'s imperial presidency misses the main event. The principal defect in Humphreys was not limitations on presidential authority to remove officials who wielded executive power, which the Constitution vests in the president alone. That was a byproduct of the court's endorsement of administrative agencies that violate separation of powers principles, consolidating the exercise of executive, legislative, and even judicial powers in a single agency. As scholars such as Stanford University's Michael McConnell have explained, the Fed's most significant activity, steering monetary policy by buying and selling securities, is essentially a legislative power. The executive authorities Congress has heaped on the Fed could easily be assigned to a different agency. That would make for a better Fed. It would also legitimize Congress's constraints on executive authority over the board. Then even this most vindictive of presidents could find better things to do than sick prosecutors on the chairman. Keeping Our Republic, Little Platoons Have Large Consequences, by Robert P. George. On the last day of the Constitutional Convention in 1787, Elizabeth Willing Powell, a prominent Philadelphia socialite, asked Benjamin Franklin what form of government was being proposed for the United States. In a reply that became famous, Franklin said, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it." Franklin's words, often cited to show that the founders recognized the profound vulnerability of the Republican order they crafted, are easily partisan fodder in times of controversy or crisis. Activists, pundits, and politicians have long invoked them to tag their opponents or their opponents' ideas as precisely the sort of existential threat to a fragile American system that the founders anticipated might arise. It is unlikely, however, that any one policy, law, or politician would pose such a threat. Even presidents who pushed the limits of their office's power, from Franklin D. Roosevelt to Donald Trump, have not dismantled our republic's core institutions or set us on a course towards autocracy, monarchy, or dictatorship. This year, as we commemorate the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, we also celebrate a quarter millennium without an American Caesar or Napoleon. Yet, there's a sense building in the national consciousness that something isn't right. A December 2025 Gallup poll found that just 24% of Americans were satisfied with the nation's direction. A Politico poll from a month prior found that 49% of Americans thought the country's best times lay in the past, while only 41% thought that Americans' best times are yet to come. As a professor, I interact frequently with young people. Among students of diverse political persuasions and worldviews, I have noticed a shared sense that our institutions, norms, and cultures, and social fabric are collectively undergoing a period of decline. As we approach the nation's 250th anniversary, why do so many people believe that America is on the brink? The answer is complex. Our civic and political structures remain fundamentally intact, even if they have been pushed to their limits in recent years and decades. Rampant judicial activism, presidential overreach, and the amassing of power in the executive branch, and Congress's abdication of legislative and oversight responsibilities have all contributed to the gradual deformation of separation of powers and the system of checks and balances conceived by our forefathers. Still, these institutions are functional, at least at the minimum necessary. Budgets are passed eventually. Guarantors of social order, such as the military, police, and criminal justice system, mostly do what they're meant to do. Civil liberties are protected, and social welfare programs chug along. After 250 years, our institutions may be struggling, but they have not failed. Even so, there is good reason behind the widespread pessimism about our country's future. While our institutions themselves may subsist, our political culture, the fundamental pillar on which the health of our institutions rests, has become severely degraded, almost to the point of dysfunction. George Washington put it well in his first inaugural address in 1789, when he noted that the preservation of the sacred fire of liberty and the destiny of the Republican model government are justly considered as deeply, perhaps as finely staked on the experiment entrusted to the hands of the American people. What Washington told us then remains true. While constitutional structures, institutions, and political systems are crucial importance, they will be effective only when they are supported by the people. That is, by the political culture. We must value our institutions enough to resist usurpations by their rulers, even when unconstitutional programs offer immediate gratification or the relief of urgent problems. For the political culture to properly underpin our constitutional structures and institutions, certain virtues must be held in practice by people. But virtues must be nurtured by each generation. James Madison said that a well-instructed people alone can be permanently a free people. That is certainly true, but Madison's words also point to the fact that even the best constitutional structures, which I believe ours to be, and the strongest structural constraints on governmental powers, which I believe are features of our system, as conceived by the founders, are mere parchment promises if the people do not understand them, value them, and have the will to resist those offering some tempting in return for giving them up. The Constitution was famously defended by Madison in Federalist No. 51 as supplying by opposite and rival interests the defect of the better motives. He made this point immediately after observing that the first task of government is to control the governed, and the second is to control itself. He allowed that a dependence on the people is, no doubt, the primary control of the government, but experience has taught mankind that necessity of auxiliary precautions. But even in this formulation, our constraints and institutions do not stand alone. Indeed, they are presented as secondary. What is primary and entirely necessary is healthy and vibrant political culture, a dependence on the people to keep the rulers in line. As the ablest scholar and political theorist of the founding generation, John Adams, understood, as well as anyone, the general theory of the Constitution, he knew that a healthy political culture was vital to ensuring that rulers stay within bounds of their legitimate authority and act as servants of the common good and of people they rule. Adams famously remarked that our Constitution is made for a moral and religious people and is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. Why? Because a people lacking in virtue could be counted on to trade liberty for protection, for financial or personal security, for comfort, or for having their problems solved quickly. In a democratic system, going all the way back to ancient Athens, there will always be people occupying or standing for public office who are happy to offer a deal, an expansion of their power in return for what they can offer by virtue of that expansion. The question, then, is how to form the people fitted with the virtues that make them capable of maintaining limited government in our constitutional structures, institutions, and political systems, even in the face of inevitable temptations to compromise it away. Here we see the significance of the most basic institutions of civil society, the family, the religious community, private organizations that are devoted to inculcation of knowledge and virtue, private educational institutions, and others play the indispensable role of transmitting essential virtues. These meditating institutions that provide a buffer between the individual and the power of the central state, it is ultimately the autonomy, integrity, and general flourishing of these institutions that will determine the fate of constitutional government. These institutions perform basic health These institutions perform basic health and education and welfare functions as the only real alternative to the removal of these functions to the government. But when government expands to play the primary role in performing them, the ideal of limited government is soon lost. No matter the formal structural constraints of the Constitution, the corresponding weakness of the statutes and authorities of these institutions damages their ability to perform all their functions, including their moral and pedagogical ones. With that, they will lose their capacity to positively influence the political culture on which they depend. It is difficult to conceive of a moment in our nation's history when institutions devoted to the cultivation of virtue have been weaker. Many of our fellow citizens do not even know what a family is anymore, let alone how to be part of one or how to start a new one. Church attendance and religious affiliation are at record lows, and under recent progressive administrations, churches and private organizations whose dedication to the formation of virtue rendered them dissenters from progressive social, cultural, and moral doctrines were investigated, defunded, sued, and otherwise targeted. This year, we mark the anniversary of a document that acknowledged certain truths to be self-evident. Among them, all men are endowed by God with unalienable rights. From the moment of our country's founding, the authors of our constitutional and political order saw their project as premised on the notion that citizenry, through diverse in ethnicity and creed, shared some fundamental premise about human nature and human person. Now, though, the foundational components meant to form good, moral, and reasonable citizens are frail. They wield less influence in our society and in our politics than they did in the past. Our bonds are weakening, our civic fabric fraying. If we are experiencing a period of American decline, it is not because of the constitutional order and the political system whose 250th anniversary we celebrate this year. The decline is attributable rather to the degradation of what Edmund Burke famously referred to as the essential little platoons of society. These building blocks of virtue, from families to voluntary associations that work together to form an informed and virtuous citizenry with the elements necessary to foster a healthy environment, democratic culture, debilitated, is it any wonder that public confidence in our ability to keep our republic is so shaky? America the Durable. How Americans Underrate Their Achievement. By Yuval Levin. On August 8, 1987, the delegates to the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia considered some miscellaneous amendments to the evolving text of Article 1 of the Constitution. In his notes from that day, James Madison recorded that, when he made brief remarks about how the proposed ratio of members to constituents in the House of Representatives would eventually render the House too big as the nation grew over decades, Massachusetts delegate Nathaniel Gorham objected to thinking so ahead as pointless. It is not to be supposed that the government will last so long as to produce this effect, Madison quoted Gorham as saying. Can it be supposed that this vast country, including the Western Territories, will 150 years hence remain one nation? It was a perfectly reasonable question. The American experiment in republicanism always seemed very precarious to its founder, to its own founders. Gorham's implicit sense that the United States might just be one transitional chapter in a story that would see numerous regimes rise and fall on this continent was widely shared. Though it was far from obvious at the time, Madison's confidence in the Republic's long-term prospects turned out to be justified. As we approach the 250th anniversary of the political endeavor launched by that generation, we should not overlook how extraordinary the longevity and durability of our regime has been. We Americans like to think of ourselves as a young nation. The European nations are old, and their roots reach back to a world that did not prioritize freedom, dynamism, toleration, or progress. The American Revolution represented a break from those ancient patterns. It launched an experimental innovation, and so stamped an inclination towards experiment and innovation under our national character. That story we tell ourselves is true, but it is not complete, and by now it might obscure more of our strength than it reveals. The United States is no longer a trial balloon. Our nation's national story may be shorter than many, but our government is actually older than pretty much any other in the world today. Only the British can claim to have institutions with the same name as those they had at the end of the 18th century. And none of those institutions really do the same work that they did back then. But the United States still has the government its people created in that age of revolutions. The American founding that began 250 years ago this year may be said to have concluded with the ratification of the Constitution 238 years ago in 1788. And we have since had the same system of government with only modest amendments and alterations. None of the old Europeans come close to that achievement. Even the steady Swiss have had three constitutions since 1798. The French like to celebrate the revolution they launched in 1789, but the regime it created was gone by 1805, and they have since cycled through more than half a dozen forms of government. Germany and Italy didn't even exist as unified nations until the middle of the 19th century, and have both gone through several regimes since then. Many other governments in Europe, Asia, Africa, and Latin America are even younger. With the sort of exception of the tiny Italian city-state of San Marino, ours is the world's oldest living republic. But our political culture is not well equipped to appreciate its own durability. We still share the apprehension of the founders that our politics hang on a knife's edge. Every generation of Americans has questioned its own capacity to sustain its political inheritance, trafficked in careless analogies to the fall of the Roman Republic, and marveled at our continuing national existence. Our civic vocabulary is deeply shared by this existential insecurity. The American National Anthem for Existence is not a celebration of beauty or glory of our country. It's a song about barely surviving the night. We all implicitly share the wonder it expresses at the improbable fact that our flag is still there. This political hypochondria contributes to the perverse apocalypticism of our time. It keeps us from dismissing as ridiculous the common suggestion that our nation is at the very edge of death, a suggestion that serves as an excuse for all manner of political recklessness. But, maybe more important still, the sense of impending doom that has long characterized our politics keeps us from learning the lessons from the American Republic's durability. The only people who comment on the sheer age of our government now are those who see it as a problem and are ashamed to live under a political order that has changed only modestly since the late 1800s. Opponents of our Constitution have long complained that we still have a system of government suited only for a crude agrarian aristocracy that couldn't possibly serve us now that things are so much more complex. Back when the framers did their work, Woodrow Wilson argued in 1887, the functions of government were simple because life itself was simple. This view has persisted and spread. It has grown thoroughly dominant among political scientists and legal scholars, but it remains as it has always been, utter nonsense. Our republic is now more than twice the age it was when Wilson dismissed it as an anachronism, and it has seen us through challenges much more complex than anything he could imagine. It has done that because the framers could imagine those immense and complicated challenges, which they could do because they, like the time they lived in, were anything but simple. In fact, the founders of our republic were keenly aware of how precarious republics tended to be. As Alexander Hamilton put it in Federalist No. 9, it is impossible to read the history of the petty republics of Greece and Italy without feeling sensations of horror and disgust at the distractions with which they were continually agitated, and at the rapid succession of revolutions by which they were kept in a state of perpetual vibration between the extremes of tyranny and anarchy, democracies, Madison noted in the very next Federalist essay, have in general been as short in their lives as they have been violent in their deaths. The careful study of such past failures led the architects of the American Republic persuaded that to avoid a quick and sorry death for our regime, they would need to find ways to counterpoise the rule of majorities with the rights of the minorities. To do that, they created a system that kept itself in balance by frustrating Wilsonian political scientists, that is, by preferring legitimacy to efficiency and sustaining simultaneous competing centers of power. The logic of the system is ultimately rooted in the moral core of the Declaration of Independence, articulated a quarter millennium ago, because we are all created equal, we are all possessed of equal rights, and we are entitled to a government that protects those rights. To be legitimate, such a government requires our consent, which, because we are all equals, it can obtain only by answering to the will of the majority. But when majorities threaten the rights of minorities or individuals, our government must remember that its fundamental purpose is the protection of those rights. So, government action cannot be legitimate if it lacks the consent of the majority, and it cannot be legitimate if it attacks the rights of the minority. How in the world is such a patchwork of contradictory demands supposed to be met by a system of government? The answer, as our Constitution demonstrates, is that it cannot be met by a government that is itself a patchwork of conflicting institutions. That's what Woodrow Wilson and a long train of confident, mistaken critics of the Constitution on all sides of our politics have always fundamentally rejected about our regime. They have sought a government moved by one integrated purpose at a time, and they argue that our Constitution's liberalism is at best unprincipled or morally neutral, and at worst a clever cover-up for corruption. But, in fact, that liberalism is a natural extension of the moral logic of the American founding, which is itself a function of our being equally created in the divine image, and it has proven itself not only principled, but also practical. That is why our system has outlived so many of its eulogists and will outlive many more. What they see as a problem with our politics is actually the solution. The durability of our system is a testament not only to its prudential ruggedness, but also its moral merits. At any given moment, some among us are almost certainly acting viciously and self-destructively. But over time, because of the ways in which our system curtails and redirects our political energies, Americans have ended up acting remarkably virtuously and constructively. Our near-term prospects often strike us as dim because we aren't gonna learning from the long arc of our history. This has been true of the anniversaries of our founding. The 50th anniversary of the Declaration in 1826, the 100th in 1876, the 150th in 1926, and the 200th in 1976, all found our nation in what Americans of those eras sensed as moments of grave danger and loss of confidence. Those Americans weren't wrong to think so, but they were wrong if they assumed, as many did, that our system could not recover its balance, sustain itself, and help us continue to flourish. Of course, past performance is no guarantee of future results, but if we could see how and why our republic has endured so long, we could grasp that it will continue to enable us to flourish if we let it continue to curtail and direct our political energies. That we are the oldest republic is a promising omen for our future, but it amounts to a promise that we can keep only if we are true to our political tradition, to the principles asserted at its outset, and to the institutions built in their light. We have lived as one nation for far longer than Nathaniel Gorham and perhaps James Madison could have imagined, and we have done it thanks to them. To help our children inherit a gift no less valuable than the one passed down to us, we should appreciate the achievement marked by our country's semi-quincentennial and grasp the counterintuitive truth that the advanced age of our republic is a good sign about its prospects. In 30 years of reading and writing founding era biographies, I have met dozens of people, many admirable, some infuriating, a few both. What have I learned from them? I began my writing This is what I learned from the founders on politics, the people, and great men by Richard Brookhiser. In 30 years of reading and writing founding era biographies, I've met dozens of people, many admirable, some infuriating, a few both. What have I learned from them? I began my writing career covering modern politics, so I was well prepared to discover that, then as now, politics is a contact sport. The journalism of the founding and the early republic offers a useful barometer. We rightly admire the best of it. The ledge graph of Thomas Paine as American crisis. These are the times that try men's soul. It is the American equivalent of King Harry's speech before Agincourt, except that it is democratic. The patriot earns not a gentler condition, but the love and thanks of a man and woman. And it was not written in real time or drumheads by campfires, but by Shakespeare 2 centuries on. Quieter but equally grave was the question Alexander Hamilton Publius proposed at the top of Federalist Number 1. Will the people of this country decide whether government can arise from reflection and choice or continue to depend on accident and force? But below such heights stretch reams of abuse and hysteria. Influencers didn't invent it. Great men approved it. Our juiciest national sex scandal was broken by James Callender in the Richmond Record, September 1st, 1802, his victim, President Thomas Jefferson. It is well known that the man, whom it delighteth the people to honor, keeps and for many years has kept as his concubine one of his slaves. Her name is Sally. The name of her eldest son is Tom. His features are said to bear a striking resemblance, although sable resemblance, to those of the president himself. The S's strewn across the whiplash sentences hiss like a serpent. Callender's tale was repeated in all available media. Jane McKinn, a Newburyport Mass engraver, drew a cartoon of a rooster with Jefferson's head strutting before a black hen and called it a philosophic cock, a pun surely intended. A poem printed in the Boston Gazette, imaging Jefferson, recalling his speculations and notes on Virginia, that black discharged waste via sweat as well as urine. What though she by the sweat gland secretes? Must I stand, shall I? Tucked up between a pair of sheets, there is no perfume like Sally. These fireworks at ground level, politicians fought real battles. When Vice President Dick Cheney shot that guy 20 years ago, it was a hunting accident and the man lived. When Vice President Aaron Burr shot former Treasury Secretary Hamilton in 1804, it was an affair of honor and Hamilton died. The election of 1800 could have ended in large-scale strife. States then chose their electors at different times, but by different means, popular vote, legislative choice, the contest between Cuban John Adams and challenger Thomas Jefferson went down to South Carolina, where the legislature on December 2nd went for Jefferson. But because two man tickets in which candidates for POTUS and V. POTUS were clearly distinguished and not yet been established by the Constitution, Jefferson and his running mate Burr finished in a tie, which would have to be broken in the new year by the House of Representatives, where the losers were still numerous enough to maintain a deadlock by voting for Burr. In this anxious interval, an article in a Washington newspaper suggested that if the House picked no winner, Congress could select an acting president. Jefferson was quietly determined to resist such a usurpation if it happened by arms. The militias of Virginia and Pennsylvania, governed by his allies, were set to supply them. His resolution and his simultaneous willingness to make such concessions to his not quite defeated enemies caused those enemies, after 35 ballots in the House, to fold their hand. The engine of such rancor was partisanship, the surprise child of the founding. The Constitution had not anticipated national political parties, and the founders can be quoted deploring them. Yet, by the early 1790s, all the founders, including Jefferson, evidently hellbound, lined up in two Federalists, George Washington, Adams, and Hamilton, versus Republicans, Jefferson and James Madison. Parties coalesced to advance the ambitions of their supporters and to back the policies, foreign and domestic, that they favored. Parties coalesced because factions, which is what Madison called such alliances dismissively before he helped organize one, are inherently to the nature of men in society. Parties were the apple of discord, they still are. But the founders also learned, as must the players in any lasting political system, the remedy, how to deal with defeat. Losers can keep watch on winners. Hamilton advanced this argument in his last appearance in the courtroom, defending a Federalist editor in upstate New York against a Republican-inspired prosecution for seditious libel. Hamilton, the advocate spoke for a free press, but also for a permanent two-party system. We have been careful that when one party comes in, it shall not be able to break down and bear away the others. A free partisan press will put us on our guard against the encroachments of power. So much for life on the out. In time, many of the losers will get back in again. Federalists may never managed it, but others defeated major parties have. The founders were politicians, just like the current crop. They had to improvise the rules as well as obey them. I have not written a biography of Thomas Jefferson, though he appears in all the ones I have written. Naturally enough, for he made his first mark before the Revolution with a summary view of the rights of British America, and marched on for 52 more years, 8 of them spent in the White House. His greatest hits, the Declaration and the Louisiana Purchase, are truly great and known to all. His eloquence, wake him up in the middle of the night and he could write something immoral, and his quirkiness, was there ever a cleverer house than Monticello, or until Pee Wee Herman's an older one, making attractive graces? Following Jefferson through the founding and the lives of his peers, however, reveals more than enough misjudgments and personal failings to ding a ordinary reputation. Bankrupt baby daddy, backstabber, economic ignoramus, cheerleader for the guillotine, Hamilton, in a letter backing him for the presidency, no less, so long as the alternative was Burr, called Jefferson a tinctured with fanaticism, mischievous, crafty, not scrupulous, not very mindful of truth, a contemptible hypocrite. John Quincy Adams, who knew him as a young man, said he had a memory so pandering to the will that in deceiving others, he seemed to have begun deceiving himself. William Herndon, Abraham Lincoln's law partner and biographer, noting his old boss's praise of Jefferson, added that Mr. Lincoln hated Thomas Jefferson as a man, rather as a politician. There was a lot to go around. Yet, when we look past the tumult and the shouting, we find that Jefferson deeply believed two things. First, that people have rights. They have them not because Jefferson or the Constitutional Congress said so, but because of what people are. This is why Jefferson's philosophic Unitarian, though he was, called rights the endowment of a creator. This is why he recognized them, even though the gritted teeth of habit and personal dependence in the people he owned. Second, Jefferson deeply believed that the people would most often be right. He believed this in part as a Virginian gentleman playing at being a human, in part because of the moral philosophy of his day. For Jefferson, the five senses on which empiricist thinkers of the previous generation had lavished so much attention were supplemented by a sixth, a moral sense, which all men had. The moral sense, he wrote one of his nephews in 1787, is as much a part of man as his leg or arm. He went on, state a moral cause to a plowman and a professor. The former will decide it as well, and often better than the latter, because he has not been led astray by artificial rules. Jefferson's two convictions don't obviously agree. You cannot believe in rights yet fear people as a potential mob. Alternatively, you could support popular rule even when it tramples on rights. Jefferson, the politician, experienced periods when the American people, plowmen included, were led astray by panics and lies. Yet, over the long haul, he believed in both rights and the people. Among those rights was self-rule. And the people, Jefferson believed, mostly exercised it wisely. We might carp at his analysis of specific political moments or fuss over his intellectual justification, but if either of his convictions is wrong, then America is wrong. My first subject was George Washington. He too appears alongside all my other subjects. He won a war and two presidential elections. Grant and Eisenhower come close, but his war was longer than both of theirs put together. And who would say that their presidencies were as consequential as his? Here we encounter a difficulty in the doctrine of rights, the very doctrine for which Washington fought and under which he presided. Since all men have rights, all men are created equal. Yet Washington, 6'3", the best horseman his age, able to pull brawling soldiers apart by the scruffs of their neck, or get the best minds of his cohort to work for and with him, keeping the malcontents in the tent as long as possible, was plainly superior. He kept an unpaid army in the field for over 8 years, and its unpaid officers loyal at war's end. No Washington, no Constitutional Convention, no Washington, maybe no presidency, or none so well begun. His aura has dimmed a bit for us because he was not eloquent. He impressed by presence and drama, recorded in a few letters and reminiscences, and captured by a handful of contemporary artworks, but his peers knew and felt it. Lots of ordinary people glimpsed the two. Add the soldiers in the Constitutional Army to the civilians who saw him as president, and the degrees of separation between him and the American in any American were very few. He was the man, and since everyone has a father, everyone at some point wants a man. Will follow one. Demagogues who know this, which is why they seek to pose as one, and see what happens when an actual great man of low or no morals appears at some fraught moment. Washington worked to draw attention to himself by horsemanship, by uniforms, by posture, by silences. Then he worked to turn the attention back. This is how he quelled the almost mutiny at Army headquarters in March 1783. The diplomats were hammering out the Treaty of Peace. Officers feared being sent home with empty IOUs or nothing at all, and appealed by some anonymous insider, had summoned them to threaten the feckless Congress. Washington had talked them down. How did he do it? By telling the men who were about to do the wrong thing that he knew they would do the right thing. You will give one more distinguished proof of unexampled patriotism and patient virtue. This is the hidden meaning of the famous gesture with the reading glasses that Washington pulled out mid-speech in order to read a relevant letter. Doing it said, "See the toll time has taken on my eyes in the Army's service." It also said, "I see you. I have seen you for years. I know who I am addressing and what I will do." This, more obviously, is the meaning of the startling third paragraph of his circular to the states, the last message he sent in June 1783 to all the governors as commander-in-chief. The paragraph begins with a survey of the blessings America enjoyed, soils, climates, treasures of knowledge, commerce, manners, revelations, and then at this auspicious period, the United States came into existence, and if their citizens should not be completely free and happy, the fault will be entirely their own. It's up to you. This is the meaning of his resignations. As commander-in-chief and president, I'm done. Congress, the people will find someone else. The superior man steps up and steps down.